These are the Keshi Tapes. U-Man and Favaz explore the backstories and interviews heard on Keshi, the longest-running rock station in the country.
It's time for another edition of the Keshi Tapes. I'm John Hewlett. You can follow me on Twitter at STLUMan and on Instagram at Johnny Hewlett. And my partner is
Favaz, Keshi Guy, Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, Keshi 95 Favaz. Clear as mud. Thank you.
What is this, episode 21?
I believe it is.
21. Today we have the Motor City Madman, Sweaty Teddy, the Nuge.
Ted Nugent.
Ted Nugent. What else do they call him?
Did you say the Motor City Madman?
Yeah, I did. I did.
Okay.
That.
All right.
You don't hear any Sweaty Teddy much anymore.
No, Uncle Ted. Sometimes you'll hear Uncle Ted.
Uncle Ted.
I would hate it if you were my uncle, but, you know.
Well, if you've been around long enough, you got that many nicknames. You've done something right.
Yes.
Now, Ted has always been a part of Keshi 95. Well, he didn't go back to 67, but probably 69, 70-ish, somewhere in that area.
Started with the Amboy Dukes, I would think.
Yeah. And he's quite the character, and he's been interviewed on this radio station many times over the years.
Countless times.
The earliest one that I remember was probably 77, 78, something like that. He came to the studio out there in Crestwood, and Mark Close interviewed him, and he was talking about spider webs in the corners of the room. He's making fun of the dump,
the
little building out there in Crestwood, and he was funny. He was funny, and he is funny now. He's also obviously very controversial.
Yes, he is.
Some people hate his guts. No matter what he says, they don't find it funny. But I think if you're in the middle and you're saying, I'm not going to punish him for his political thoughts or anything he's done in the past. I'm just a supporter of his music and his ability to entertain. I think if you're down the middle, you got to admit, at the very minimum, he's entertaining.
Absolutely. And this interview shows it because he talks about Keshi in St. Louis. So there's no, as far as I can remember, no political rantings on his part. And, you know, he always goes on a rant, it seems like. But on this one, he doesn't. And it's from 2007. This is his Hall of Fame, Keshi Hall of Fame induction interview. He came in that day.
Where was this done?
This was done in the old Keshi studio back in the powerhouse. And do you remember when we used to do those request-a-thons for the Ronald McDonald House?
Yeah.
He happened to be in town for an NRA thing, and we got him to come on, you know, the radio that afternoon. He stayed for like 2 hours.
Oh, yeah. He loves
it. And he played Great White Buffalo on guitar in front of me. I was just blown away because Ted was my hero, my guitar hero, back when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I had met him before, but to have him on my show and doing those things was incredible. So during songs, a big block of songs, whatever, we did this interview, and this part never made it onto the radio. It just made it onto the Real Rock Hall of Fame online. And that's where we got it from.
He was also your hero back in the day when you used to wear a loincloth.
My loincloth has since been retired as his.
Yes. So. All right. Ready?
Ready.
Here we go. Ted Nugent.
Oh, by the way, so I'm real low in this interview for those people listening, so you might have to turn it up a little bit. Ted is at normal volume, but I'm not really on a microphone as before.
Favaz here?
Oh, you can embrace the listener through the
first
wall.
Cool.
I
embrace.
Right. Say Favaz here?
I don't remember. I can't get really to tell.
Okay. So, Come back. All right, we ready? All right. So, Ted, what's your reaction on being elected into the Keshi Real Rock Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, I have a great spiritual connection with Keshi because that baptismal eruption in 1967 that really happened in Detroit on WABX, in Boston on WBCN.
By the way, WABX was our sister station in Detroit when Century Broadcasting owned Keshi up until 1983.
Hey, he's got a great memory. I mean, if you know, this stuff right here from 1960, you know, he remembers this stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he was never addicted to drugs. He was addicted to sex.
Yes.
We'll get to that later.
San Francisco.
Yeah. Promise?
Call letters evade me right now, but Keshi was that first initial throb of uninhibited free-for-all rock and roll radio. And I was here 40 years ago when that happened, so I've always referenced St. Louis and this whole heartland with Keshi Radio. So to be inducted into the Keshi Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I believe that this is probably an honest Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It probably doesn't have
clicks.
Who was some of the numbnuts they put in here recently? I can't even think of Flash.
Flash Master Jay,
and some dirty hippie that. Patti Smith. You probably won't have Patti Smith in yours unless you have a court jester section.
I agree with him, not because she's, in his words, a dirty hippie,
right,
but because I just don't think she belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall
of
Fame.
No, I don't either.
She had a hit with a Bruce Springsteen song,
right,
and that was it.
Yeah, I don't get the influence that she's had. But if you talk to some bands, they're like, oh, yeah, Patti Smith, ooh, blah. But, yeah, to hear Ted talk about it's pretty. And he also said numbnuts. And you never hear numbnuts very much.
Those good old phrases from the 70s. What's up, numbnuts?
But being that as it may, I am truly honored. I am moved because the circle shall go unbroken. Chuck Berry started it here. I genuflected at the altar of Chuck Berry and all his musical genius that inspired this whole thing. And to be so recognized as the son of Chuck Berry in St. Louis on Casey is a moment of pride and glory. God bless the Casey dream, baby.
Man, like I said, he is entertaining. He can spin a yarn. He can spin a phrase. He, again, you love him, you hate him. But the dude can articulate a point.
And what he just articulated there couldn't be more true.
Yeah.
Chuck Berry started it all, really.
It was eloquent.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't especially use too many... You don't use that word very often when you're talking about Ted.
Yes,
but
what he was talking about was, you know, Chuck and his lyrical prowess that he had with his songs, and he played guitar. Ted played almost the same kind of guitar that Chuck did. It was a hollow body guitar, and you know, and his some of Ted, "Wang Dang Sweet Poontang."
Yeah,
that's a funny song.
Yeah,
you know,
Chuck Berry, "My Ding-a-Ling."
Yeah,
you know?
Right, exactly.
That's probably where he got "Wang Dang Sweet Poontang" from.
All right, one big concert I remember you playing, Super Jam 77, the old Busch Stadium.
Yeah, the old Busch Stadium.
Mario Speedwagon. And, of course, that was the release of Cat Scratch Fever. Do you remember that?
I remember it well, yes. I remember, you know, I had performed at every stadium concert when they first started that whole concept. And I've always loved the intimacy of a club. And that's where the Amboy Duke started, and where you only had to play when you first start. And so you look in people's eyes, and you kind of get the feedback, you get that emotion, you get that spontaneity, you get that primal scream, eyeball to eyeball.
Hence the name of one of his albums.
A flesh-to-flesh sweat communication going. However, the only thing better than that is when you have 80,000 people doing the same thing, and you're not only able to look at the people in the front row and get that Wang Dang Sweet Poontang thing going because it was hot and sunny, and my, you're dressed in barely visible attire.
And Ted gets jacked up on stage. Oh, I'm sorry. He gets jacked up on stage, and when he's in Nashville, occasionally he will address a certain portion of the audience.
You mean Nashville Pussy? Yeah. Yes, from Double Live Gonzo. I remember. Well, I used to play it all the time, John.
But I'd accidentally play it on air.
I know you did. I've heard that story from Ray Collier before. But he's just saying, oh my, look at you. You're barely dressed in your whatever. That's what he's talking about. Because Ted played some huge festivals with huge amounts of people. And he's talking about Busch Stadium back in 1977.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, you interrupted his.
You mean to back it up a little?
No. I don't know.
No, just back it up.
Okay.
Just a little bit.
He was talking about the girls in the front row.
Barely visible attire, and you look so charming that way. You get that, plus the magnification of this sea of humanity where all the clenched fists and all the howling, laughing, smiling faces and the dancing are absolute an extension of the music and the rhythms that you're playing on stage. I remember it well. And those were historic landmarks. In fact, we still do concerts with REO Speedwagon and with Heart and with Aerosmith and with Cheap Trick, which were the nucleus of those concerts back then. And we all talk about that kind of stuff, specifically about the Busch Stadium concert. So, yes, I was a lucky man to be a part of that.
Talk about the relationship. It doesn't exist so much.
I remember being at that concert.
I wasn't.
No?
Yeah. That's where I first heard of Ted, because I think my next-door neighbor went, and he had a copy of the Cat Scratch Fever vinyl. I was like, who's Ted Nugent? And they kind of told me, I just saw him at Busch Stadium.
Yeah, it was brutally, brutally hot that day.
Yeah.
And, of course, we were on the turf. You know, they still had the artificial turf.
Yeah, they did.
The heat was just, the place was an oven. Who was the old baseball guy that, I think it was Stacy. Anyways, they asked him, he came here for an all-star game here at Busch Stadium. It was 65 or something, right after it opened. And I said, what do you think of the new Busch Stadium here? He goes, well, it holds the heat well.
Right, because he had to change his shoes or something like that?
No, that was Willie McGee who was talking about, okay. I think. But anyway, yeah, the place was just a concrete oven, and then they put plastic grass in.
Right.
So it was just brutal that day.
Right.
But, yeah, the show went off, but a lot of people were taken to the hospital.
New artist now, but, you know, you go back with Casey 40 years. Talk about the relationship between artists and radio station, how those, in your day, those relationships were really...
Casey Stengel.
Thanks.
Was the name I was trying to remember.
I was waiting on that.
Developed and nurtured along the way.
It's with a jaundiced eye that a tear flows down my rosy cheek.
A jaundiced eye.
So that means a yellow eye.
That a tear flows down his cheek. Where in the hell's he going?
Remembering that there actually was a relationship between an artist who so cherished the authenticity and integrity of the musical vision they collaborate to provide, and the radio stations that assisted in conveying that musical collaboration, that it doesn't exist today is an indictment to the soullessness of the music industry.
Wow.
Ooh.
That's powerful
stuff,
right?
That was a long time ago, too. Yeah. People still feel that way about it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the year of this interview again?
Yeah, this was in 07. Mm-hmm.
There was a time where the people at the record store loved the music, and the people at the radio station loved the music, and the artists loved the music, and the promoters loved the music. And when all those professional business entities collaborated on a professional, responsible level, the people who loved the music, and for the most part were the inspiration for the music, would have it on all levels. The creator, the artist, the radio station that conveyed it and celebrated it over the airwaves, the music store that didn't just sell it, but celebrated in window displays, and the guy behind the counter knew the lyrics and knew the song and knew the artist, and the promoter who wanted it, not just because they sold tickets, but they really liked the spirit and the attitude of the music. It was a huge musical family. And
yeah, he's right. He's totally right.
Definitely right. Mm-hmm. And it changed once... Once people started figuring out what was happening and how this music was being received and what was possible in terms of being able to make money,
right.
things Rich, spun out of control.
Rich Robinson of the Black Crowes was just here, and he said he blames everything on the banks.
Well, things spun out of control to the point where the artists became secondary and the fans became secondary, and the most important thing became the money.
Right.
How much could the promoter make? How much could the record company make? Record company has always had their hands in there, even in the early days.
Yeah.
But boy, once they started finding out what they had and this genre was starting to evolve and become spectacular, it lost heart. It lost soul.
Mm-hmm. Spoiled rotten because all those elements, yeah, they're commercial entities and they're corporate entities, but you can't get potatoes without somebody bringing the potatoes to the store. You got to be able to sell the potatoes if you want to have some good potato food. You can't have good rock and roll if the guys who make it and the guys that deliver it and the guys that sell it and the guys that play it live all work together so that people get the whole wad. But there was a difference then. The music erupted spontaneously and genuinely, honestly, from those black artists that inspired Aerosmith and the Stones and the Beatles and Elvis and the Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin and everybody. And certainly the Ted Nugent Band and certainly the Amboy Dukes and certainly Cheap Trick and certainly Heart and certainly REO. Those original black artists and their honest emotion was the fiber, was the glue that molded that music into a meaningful commodity for the people who wanted that emotion and that primal scream and the soundtrack that went with it. I'm sorry to say that many artists, only the guilty need to feel guilty. You still have absolute virtuosos like Joe Bonamassa, Christina Aguilera. You still got guys like even Velvet Revolver. They love the music. They're going to play the music that's in their heart, and if it sells, great. But they want the collaboration of those business entities to help maximize the vehicle by which the music can be conveyed. You can't put gas in your tank if you don't sell some potatoes. So, yeah, those, I can tell you, those were the good old days. And even though I'm having the greatest tours of my life today, it's almost, and again, only the guilty need to feel guilty, but it's almost in spite of the fragmentation. There is no bond between music stores and radio stations and promoters and artists anymore. Back then, it was a bond. When there was a concert in town, the radio station played that artist's music, played that art, played the song all the time. There was a window display at retail level. The concert promoter loved it, so we made sure he coordinated with those two. And the artist came in and felt home because everybody was celebrating his art form, and then more people showed up, and everybody won. Nowadays, I do radio interviews at some places in this country, and while I'm doing interviews, they're playing somebody else's music. Well, that's just chimp-like. I mean, you have to be like a, you know, an offshoot of a orangutan not to see how rude that is. So
true, but you agreed to do the interview, Ted. I mean, you had to know going in whether or not it was a
music. Right.
I think he's talking mainly about talk stations where he'll do a lot of interviews, and they can't play music, and they have their music beds already worked out, and they come in and out of their segments.
He could be.
And that's, I think he's probably referring to
but
that.
But what he's saying, though, is so true, and it's unfortunate that the younger crowd didn't get to experience what you and I have experienced, what he was talking about, that, you know, somebody puts out a song and the radio station loves it, and then you can buy it at the music store and the music store person there knows it, and, you know, they come to town and the promoter wants to get involved, and it's just he's talking real here.
Well, there's a disconnect today that breaks my heart, but there's still enough of a camaraderie and a unification that I find, especially today at Keishi 100 years later, that you can find often enough to buoy your spirit and to solidify the delivery of the music that is such an enriching part of all of our lives. Music is the soundtrack for the human experience. And if you can't optimize it and maximize the professional delivery thereof, nobody wins. So I relish those days, and I mine, M-I-N-E, I mine and cultivate that connection today. And it's still available, but it takes an awful lot of effort.
He's right.
Yeah.
You know, and it's nice that he has those things to say about Keishi, because even, you know, now, the way things are, we still are tight with, you know, the artists that have been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's great to ask Ted Nugent or Kevin Cronin of REO or Sammy Hagar, you know, people that have had long relationships with the radio station. Hey, do you remember this? Do you remember playing here? And to hear their stories is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he's also referring to days when the artists were able to make mistakes, not have a successful release, and record companies gave them a little more space back then to evolve as musicians and as writers. And, you know,
now there's no investment. There's no investment from the record companies. Hey, you know, you make one crappy album, you're gone.
You're done.
You're done.
Yeah. And, it was an innocent time. You know, it was an innocent time. Well, the art form was still being invented and evolving. It's to the point now where I think they got it down to such a formula that there. I don't know how you put the heart back in it. You know, you just can't. You're gonna have to go to something that we're not familiar with. There are internet radio stations where they'll play all kind of eclectic music, but they don't catch on. They don't have any kind of influence in the business, because they can't garner enough listenership to make it work. So I don't know how it goes back to the days that Ted would love it to go back to, but not going to.
But the good thing about it is there are stations like Keishi, and we're tooting our own horn here. You can listen on the app. You can listen on the internet. And we're one of those stations that still, while we're evolving and we're doing social media and we're doing podcasts and things like that, it's still old school to a certain extent we still play Ted Nugent. And when Ted comes down, and if he wants to come in, well, we would be more than happy to have him. You know, it's those kind of things.
And we still have a free form radio show on the air on Sunday mornings, Keishi Classic Show, or play whatever.
And we still play records on Sunday night, the seventh day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Full albums.
So we're still trying.
Is this over with? Or
no, keep going.
One final serious question. How many chicks have you banged in St. Louis?
18,000. Or just St. Louis. That's 22,600. And that was last week.
No. Damn.
Thank you very much.
I've never fucked. I just don't fuck.
Now, you heard that. Okay.
Oh, my God.
All right. So that whole thing at the end. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Ted, like I said, he was known for having a sex addiction with really young girls rather than, you know, he never smoked pot or anything like that.
I almost brought that up when he was talking about the girls in the front row of the concert.
Right. So that's why I asked that question at the end, because I just wanted to see what kind of reaction I would get. But if you remember the first time I met Ted Nugent, and it was a thrill, it was the time that he brought the cassette from Fred Bear. Do you remember Fred Bear?
Yes.
The first time that we ever heard it was from him. And Smash was doing the mornings, and you were. And I was driving Ted Nugent back to his hotel in my Cavalier that day. And it was the freakiest thing. It was just weird. Carl Middleman, the intern, was there. And Ted was all over our intern, who was like 15, 16.
Yeah.
And I don't remember her name.
When you say all over, like what was said?
He was firing on her. And in fact, maybe not then, but it was when he came back for the damn Yankees, he was all over. That's what it was. And she put him in his place.
What'd she say?
She said she wasn't interested. And
good,
I guess,
for her.
Yeah. And this was, it had to have been 1991. So it was right at that time that she would have been an intern. And I can't remember her name. And she was super cool. But it just, you know, years later, when you hear about Ted and his affinity for younger women and stuff, well, kind of makes sense. And that was Ted's big thing. He was not a drug addict. He didn't drink, but he loved young girls.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. He also had his issues back in the day, too, during the Vietnam War. Now, it's disputed, but supposedly he dodged the draft, bragged about it back in the late 70s, about how he was going to go to the draft board and he was going to make them not want him. So he didn't bathe for a long period of time, made himself smell, urinated, supposedly defecated in his pants or whatever. And like 20 years later, he said, no, that didn't happen. I was just entertaining myself with that story.
But
when it comes to Ted, he might have been. I don't know.
Might have.
But he did not serve. And he did find a way out of the Vietnam War.
You know, having him in that day was great. It was, like I said, he was one of those guys for me. I used to have his posters on my wall. And then years later, I met him down in Cabo with Sammy Hagar, because he came to, he would come down for Sammy's birthday gigs and stuff like that. And he actually remembered me, and I'll never forget the one time I came up to him. He goes, "Favaz, you handsome son of a bitch, how you been?" And that was funny. Just so funny. And it's you say what you want about him, but like you said, he's very entertaining. He has a great way with words of sometimes it gets him in trouble.
Sure.
You know, but when you're talking about music, there isn't much better than Ted Nugent.
When you're talking about music, and he knows his music and his music history.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, he is a fan of the music industry and musicians. And in those, did you have like any intimate settings where you're just sitting around having a beer with him?
Out at the amphitheater I did for Damn Yankees and stuff like that.
What does
like
he
that.
Talk about?
I honestly don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah. All right. Well, he was very entertaining here. We have other interviews with Ted Nugent from the past, too, on other.
Right. And we have other interviews that you can see online right now at KSHE95.com in the Real Rock Hall of Fame. Part of that interview that you just heard is there. That's the whole thing. You know, it gets edited. That's the whole interview. So if you want to check out the, you know, I think you should just listen. You've heard what you've heard right here. You don't need to.
Yeah. But the Hall of Fame, the KSHE Real Rock Hall of Fame is very,
is
very,
really,
very
really
impressive.
Cool. So.
All right. Thanks for checking this out again today, our 21st episode of the KSHE Tapes. Try to keep it going, man. I don't know what's next week, but we'll be rummaging through.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah,
we're still doing A-listers. We got plenty to go.
We'll thumb through our interviews and keep finding stuff for you. I'm John Hewlett. You can follow me on Twitter at STLUman and on Instagram at Johnny Hewlett.
Favaz, KSHE Guy, Instagram, Twitter, KSHE95 Favaz, Facebook.
Adios.
Adios.
My friend.
Talker.
You're as bad as Ted.
No.
The KC Tapes with you, man, and Favaz. For more on the history of KC, go to KC95.com or the KC mobile app.